In Puerto Rico, they call themselves Boricua. But Boricua is more than a name for a person from Puerto Rico. It's a way of life that means embracing the beauty that surrounds you, seeking adventure no matter where it may lead, and sharing that vibrant spirit with everyone you meet. And you can experience all that warm, welcoming, passionate culture set in a tropical island paradise without the need for a passport for U.S. citizens or permanent residents. Learn more about how you can live Boricua at discoverpuertorico.com. In Puerto Rico, they call themselves Boricua. But Boricua is more than just a word to identify a person from Puerto Rico. It's a way of life that means embracing the beauty that surrounds you, seeking adventure, and sharing that vibrant spirit with everyone you meet. In Puerto Rico, you can experience a tropical paradise with world-class beaches. You can immerse yourself in the rich 500-year history of Old San Juan, where there are stunning forts, classic town plazas, and iconic monuments. You can indulge in a foodie paradise with renowned restaurants, seaside kiosks, and an innovative cocktail scene. And you can take in an abundance of natural wonders like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. National Forest System, all without the need for a passport for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more about the warm culture of Puerto Rico and how you can live Boricua at discoverpuertorico.com.
Toronto never used to be a diverse city. Toronto was, you know, like America at one time, was ruled by the British. And Britain controlled our immigration, so there wasn't much immigration at all until the end of the Second World War, when Canada started to control its own immigration, and we opened the doors to the world. And this market was very much at the center of that.
I'm standing in the entryway to the St. Lawrence Market. It's huge with high arch ceilings and produce, fresh meat and fish and food vendors everywhere. And that gentleman you just heard, he's kind of like the history king of the market.
Hello, I am Bruce Bell. I am the historian and tour guide here at St. Lawrence Market in downtown Toronto. For the last 25 years now, I've been doing this.
And I'm Aislinn Green, and this is Unpacked, the podcast that unpacks one tricky topic in travel each week. And this week, as part of our unpacking series, we are in Toronto, one of the most diverse cities in the world. At least 180 languages are spoken here, but it wasn't always like that. Bruce grew up in Northern Ontario and has lived in Toronto for almost 50 years. And he tells me that when he was a kid in the 1960s, even something as innocent as garlic was viewed as something unseemly.
You know, it wasn't British. And, you know, my mother's British, my dad's British, they came over after the war. My mother never even heard of garlic. And the only thing she heard was, don't have your kitchen have these strong smells. But she started to cook, and she loved cooking. And I remember the first time I smelled garlic in the house, and she said, don't tell anybody. So the market, you couldn't even buy garlic here. But as the city started to really grow, more people from other countries were coming in. You know, the market really took on a different flair. And now, yes, there are many different groups, different ethnic groups that have stalls here.
The market is electrifying. We pass a stand called Family Food Market, where asparagus and carrots and, yes, garlic are bundled in tidy rows. We check out oysters and fresh British Columbia salmon at Seafront Fish Market, whose yellow sign is in the shape of a sail. Bruce also introduces me to Carousel Bakery, a must-stop if this is your first visit to Toronto.
The signature sandwich of Toronto is a pea meal bacon sandwich. That's what everyone comes to this market for. I'll show you the stall. It's five pieces of this Canadian pea meal. They fry it up, and you get five slices on a bun and a little bit of mustard, and it's a wonder. It's very tasty.
I ask Bruce, what on earth is pea meal bacon?
Pea meal bacon was invented here at the market in about 1880. A butcher named William Davies. They needed to, you know, preserve pork. They used to dip it in a brine of salt, take it out, and then roll it in crushed peas. And that kind of kept it together. Today they use corn, and corn holds it together even better. But they kept the name pea meal bacon. So when you walk through the market, you'll see everyone at lunchtime eating a pea meal bacon sandwich. It's very tasty.
Next, Bruce guides me downstairs, and this is where the real lunch options are.
One of my favorite places we're passing this is all Eastern European, Hungarian, Russian, Polish food, true comfort food.
Oh, they have pierogies.
Oh, and known for their pierogies.
Yes. What pierogies do you
have? Oh, my God. I just love this so much. And I have the hardest job in the world. And right here is a French crepe place. Crepes are very popular here in Toronto. They're everywhere.
But we're not eating yet. There's still more to see. For a short time, the market served as City Hall, and there are certain reminders left.
We're now in the basement of the old City Hall. We're looking at an old jail, the one wall left from the old prison from colonial times, where men were chained to the wall.
We leave the former prison behind and turn to a more positive scene.
There is a mural on this wall, and it's a massive mural of people having fun, and the market is painted in there, as you can see. And, you know, this was unheard of 50 years ago.
And that's because Bruce tells me that 50 plus years ago, this was a rather serious city.
In the 1950s, they made sure you couldn't even play baseball on a Sunday in Toronto, let alone go to the movies, any of that. It was a very, very pious, dull city, but it was an easy place to do business.
Bruce says that began to change in the 1950s. Movie theaters and theaters and other forms of entertainment that the city is now so well known for began to open. It took a while, though, for it to really take off. And then, in the early 1960s, two iconic cultural events took place.
It wasn't until 1964, March 15th, with the arrival of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And they were the hot couple at the time. And they came to our city, but they weren't married to each other, and they were sleeping in the same bed. And there were people protesting outside the hotel, the King Edward Hotel. But there were also a lot of supporters, too. And that was the turning point, was the arrival of Liz and Dick, that people started to say, you know, we want to start having a bit more fun. And a few months after that, the Beatles came, stayed in the same room as Liz and Dick. So those are the bookends. That was truly the beginning of a very modern Toronto. It was Liz, Dick, and the Beatles, all in the same year.
So the mural represents Toronto's growth and transformation. The city's entertainment district, where all of the nightclubs are located and fantastic restaurants, is now a huge draw for locals and travelers alike. The mural also has a little Easter egg for sharp-eyed visitors.
But what makes this famous... There's a picture of me in there.
Goodness, you're in the mural.
I am in the mural. I've been writing for a newspaper now for over 25 years. I have a monthly column. And 20 years ago, they put me in the mural.
That's amazing.
I'm still there.
The mural is bright and vivid with people singing and dancing and eating. And I see that there's a woman holding a newspaper that features a giant photo of Bruce Bell's face.
You look kind of like, who's the actor that I'm thinking of?
But with like Wayne Newton?
Maybe.
I get Elvis, Wayne Newton, and Clark Gable.
This is very handsome mural here.
As you may have guessed, in today's episode, you'll get to tag along with me as I revel in Toronto's diverse and surprising fun. But let's be honest, the city is 244 square miles, and that's not even counting all the suburbs. And it's home to 3 million people. So this is in no way a comprehensive overview of Toronto. At first, I was a little overwhelmed by that fact on my trip. Like, how could I possibly see or do everything? And then I realized that this is just one of those cities that you really should develop a relationship with, to visit again and again and explore different pockets each time, letting its mysteries unfold over those visits. I'm on a ferry. The wind is ruffling my hair, and as we push back from the mainland, I begin to see the CN Tower, one of the city's main landmarks, appear from behind skyscrapers. The ferry is taking me to the Toronto Islands, a series of three islands that are just 15 minutes from the mainland. They're one of the many places that Matthew Jordan might talk about on one of his Hidden Rivers walking tours.
I get emotional even just thinking about like walking around downtown, walking around the waterfront, seeing the island. It's really, really beautiful.
Because this is a travel podcast, we're going to refer to Matthew today as a tour guide, but he does a whole lot more.
I am a historian of science and technology. I'm a teacher. I'm an educator. I've taught at universities. I've taught young technology entrepreneurs and engineers in Silicon Valley about the history and philosophy of technology. Currently, I am in Cambridge, Massachusetts, helping teach a course at Harvard University about Taylor Swift. So I've taught a great many subjects in a great many geographies, but Toronto is my home.
I had so many questions about his Taylor Swift class, but that's not what this is about. So back to his tour company. He launched it during the pandemic, during what was a pretty dismal time.
I found it really, really hard to be in Toronto, partially because I think that I thought of Toronto as being about concerts and sports games and tall buildings and events and big city stuff. And so that was my, if that's your conception of a city, of course, being locked down and unable to do any of that is going to, you're going to feel, what's even the point of being in a city like that?
Developing his tour was like a mental 180.
Those things are really wonderful. The CN Tower is great. Toronto's skyscrapers are great. We have a wonderful, you know, downtown, but that's not what Toronto is about. What Toronto to me is about is something that actually is summarized on all of the parks in the city, all of the names of the parks on the signs. When you go to any park, there's a motto at the top of the sign that says a city within a park. To me, that's what Toronto is about.
On his tours, he takes people through those natural spaces and explains how the city was formed. And he starts way back in history.
My tour starts at the end of the last ice age, approximately 12,000 years ago, when much of what we now call Toronto, and indeed much of Canada, Ontario, was covered in a gigantic glacier, and that glacier began to melt as the earth heated up. Hundreds of years of fast-moving water carves out the ground, right? And in so doing, it carves out huge ravines, big indentations in the ground, oftentimes leaving behind, you know, a legacy of a river that runs the course of that glacial trajectory.
This shaped the city's geography.
The city of Toronto has a very unique feature of being kind of on an angle. All of the city slopes downward into Lake Ontario. Like I mentioned, these melting glaciers defined the shape of the city. So the glaciers melt downhill, so to speak. And so all this river flows into Lake Ontario. The city has a kind of natural compass. Now, this makes it very easy to navigate in Toronto, actually, because south is always downhill. And south is facing towards, you know, the waterfront, towards the CN Tower, towards the lakeshore. So if you're going downtown, you're literally going downhill.
As Matthew continued to explore, he stumbled upon a surprising fact.
So Toronto is the city with the largest ravine system in the entire world, was one of the first things that I learned in my research. That was not something that I had ever been told.
Many of those ravines became the city's best parks, like Trinity Bellwoods, a grassy, tree-filled space in a neighborhood that shares the same name.
Many of these parks are huge indentations in the ground. They have very interesting topological features, but you don't really think about it like that. It's just a beautiful park that you can sit, have a picnic, lying on a slope. Where did all those slopes come from, right? Where did the geography of the city come from? And how has it come to be the way it is now? That's what started obsessing me.
He gets into all of this on his tours, and this is how a tour might start.
The main walking route that I would do took us through the Tattle Creek, which is one of these buried underground waterways. It's called Philosopher's Walk. It's a part of the campus of the University of Toronto, and it's a beautiful kind of walkway. And I'd walked that a lot during my childhood. My grandparents lived right around the corner, and I never knew that you're walking above a river the whole time, right? And so that's where we would start. And so I could kind of start with a bang, you know, blow people's minds a little bit right from the jump.
He would also take people to Nordheimer Ravine, a kind of hidden spot northish of downtown. Many years ago, the ravine wasn't really anything special.
And then over the course of the last 75 years, largely through volunteer work, the people of Toronto have planted a ton of trees, done a ton of like regenerative forestry and flowers and working of the soil and this kind of thing. And Nordheimer Ravine is now beautiful because of the like very concerted, very deliberate effort of a great many nature-friendly Torontonians.
He hopes that these tours will inspire people to take care of their own cities.
It's part of the geological, ecological heritage of the city. And so I feel very lucky to be showcasing it and also showcasing that like this is only so beautiful and so nice because like a lot of work went into it, right? And a lot of volunteer work. So part of my goal is to like inspire that sense of, I don't know, civic action on the part of the people.
Matthew's tours begin in May, and this year he's changing things up a bit.
This summer, I am going to be doing things in a way that looks a bit more like kind of drops. Every week or every other week, I might do like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday one area of the city or one set of areas. For instance, I might do a waterfront tour. I'm going to do a Garrison Creek tour, an East End tour, Don Valley. So different themes so that as many people as possible can attend.
Because Toronto is such a rapidly growing city, there is a lot of construction happening at all times. But if Matthew ever feels a sense of loss, he focuses back on what he teaches in his tours.
What that led me to understand is that there is one thing that they can never take away. They can never take away the ravines, right? They can never take away the stuff that has been here for hundreds of thousands, millions of years. There's a permanency when you're standing on the Prince Edward Viaduct, looking over the Don Valley, when you're looking at the Humber River, when you're looking at the Scarborough Bluffs. There's a sense that, okay, this is something that's forever. This is what the city is about. Buildings will come up and buildings will come down, but this is the real heart of the city.
If you enjoyed our recent episode on Native tourism, then you should check out Toasted Sister, an award-winning show that documents the Native American food movement. Hosted by Andy Murphy, Toasted Sister talks with dozens of Native chefs, farmers, and individuals in the food industry who are working towards Indigenous food sovereignty. Each episode includes topics of sovereignty, racism, sexism, politics, and health, and a lot of personal stories about connecting with food, flavor, and culture. So go ahead, listen to Toasted Sister on your favorite podcast app. I'm staying in the city center, surrounded by the hustle and bustle. I hear languages and music, and bonus, it's just a 5-minute walk from one of the most surprising museums I've ever visited.
Well, we are the only shoe museum in North America. We have the world's most comprehensive collection of international shoes in the world.
That is Elizabeth Semmelhack. She's the director and senior curator for the Bata Shoe Museum. As I walk up to the museum, there is a giant white and neon 80s athletic sneaker emblazoned on the side of the 4-story museum. Because yes, there is an exhibition on 80s footwear, and it is killer. We'll get to that shortly. But first, why a shoe museum?
So the museum was started by Mrs. Sonia Bata, and she started collecting shoes after she married Mr. Bata. The Bata Shoe Company was rebuilding after World War II. And she began to travel the world with her husband, and she made an astute observation, which is people's feet are basically the same, no matter where you go, but what they have traditionally put on them can be remarkably different. And so she thought, what were the causes for those differences?
So Mrs. Bata began to collect footwear, lots of footwear. As of 2024, there are more than 15,000 artifacts housed here.
The oldest piece we have is 4,500 years old. The most contemporary are some NFT sneakers for the metaverse. In 1995, she had this museum built by Raymond Moriyama. And we opened our doors to the public, and we have been an actively collecting institution and research center ever since.
The museum has 3 temporary exhibition spaces and a permanent gallery that hints at the stories that shoes hold. The museum also conserves footwear, although Elizabeth is quick to say that they don't restore.
One of the things that actually is important to us is to preserve evidence of wear. We have a pair of Elvis Presley shoes. And so you can see sort of how he's dancing on stage by looking at the wear pattern. So we want to make sure to preserve evidence of wear, but we want to also ensure that things are conserved. So if something, let's say it's beautifully beaded, but the bead string has come loose and the beads are starting to fall off, those beads that have fallen off will be returned and then the bead string will be secured. But we won't make things look brand new again.
Elizabeth's background is in art history, and while she didn't set out to steward a shoe museum, she loves her work. We're now sitting in her office. She has a mug that says, "Warning, I may start talking about shoes at any time," and on her walls are dozens and dozens of pictures. I see a Peter Max illustration, a photo of a can of acrylic spray that looks like it's from the 1950s, and many, many shoes.
What I saw was that shoes are everywhere, really always have been, and that the core questions that drive me, which is looking at the intersections of gender and economics and fashion and things that are mass consumed, yeah. I could ask those questions of shoes. And what I have found over the years is that any question I have about society, culture, I can find a pair of shoes that will help me sort of start going down that path.
She takes me through some of the current exhibits. And yes, of course, I ask her about her own footwear.
In every interview, do people ask you what you're wearing on your feet?
No, but that does happen quite a bit. And that is the biggest hazard of the job.
Yeah. Well, because I imagine...
I don't have time to shoe shop.
Exactly. The shoes that you shop for, I would imagine, are like the shoes that we're seeing here. You know, it's a different kind of shoe shopping.
Yes. I mean, I'm constantly looking to acquire for the museum.
Yes. Yeah.
But what will actually fit me?
Yeah.
We're now in the 1980s exhibit called Dress to Impress, an exploration of footwear and consumerism in the 1980s. And it will be there until March 2025.
I did not curate this exhibition. Nishi Bassi did, our curator, and she wanted to look at what was happening with consumerism in the 1980s, the rise of the mall, the rise of multiple different sort of personalities you could take on through how you dressed. It was a very eclectic moment, but what unified it, which was reflected in the title here, is that everyone was dressing to impress. And so the exhibition is laid out like a 1980s mall. It's very nostalgic. And then each of the shops deals with a different topic.
One of those topics is dress for success. It's all about women entering the white-collar workplace and the pressures put on what was quote-unquote appropriate for them to wear.
One of the more overlooked set of shoes would be this trio here of what feel like very conservative shoes. But they reflect that when women entered the white-collar workplace, they did not have the man's suit, which had already been for over a century, a signifier of male authority. So how were women to be taken seriously? What were they to wear?
Elizabeth says that there were books written about how women should wear men's inspired blazers and modest skirts. So kind of a feminine take on the classic male power suit. But then the question was, what do you wear on your feet?
Flats were considered unattractive. Super high heels were too sexy. Mm-hmm. So the power heel, and this was when the term starts to be used, the power heel of the 1980s was a low, modest heel that suggested that you were all business.
We move to a shoe that makes me laugh. Though that's not really fair to the shoe because it was quite revolutionary in its time.
So the rarest shoe in the gallery is this one, number one. This is called the RS computer shoe. It was made by Puma in 1986.
Here's the part that makes me laugh.
This had a microchip in it. And so after you ran, it came with a floppy disk. You plugged the plug into the back of the sneaker and the other part you plugged into your recommended Commodore 64. And it told you how far you'd run, how many calories you burned.
Sadly, it did not do well in the marketplace.
It was not a hot seller. It's a little clunky.
But it laid the groundwork for all the wearable tech that we use to track our heart rates and steps today. So that Apple Watch that you wear, you have this hefty 80s shoe to thank.
Yeah. And so, but it's this technology, right, that has now been transformed into something that's a part of our everyday lives.
Easy to kind of laugh at.
I know. But
so
truly.
Trend-setting.
Well, the personal computer was becoming a part of our lives in the mid-1980s. These are cutting-edge materials, things that are going to have ramifications well into the future.
Elizabeth says that the museum doesn't specifically focus on Canadian footwear, but the newest exhibit called Exhibit A has a Canadian spin. It's all about crime and footwear, forensics, and the concepts of criminality.
And in that exhibition, we feature two famous Canadian crimes. And then we actually end the exhibition by looking at the Kingston Penitentiary, which used shoemaking as a form of prisoner reform.
The exhibit, which will run through the summer, focuses on a classic aspect of forensics.
Footprint is left.
How do you find the killer through?
And so it actually opens with a pair of butler shoes. You know, the butler did it, right? The whodunit. And yet, what is that trope about? You know, butlers are supposed to move around silently. And so the butler's shoes that we happen to have in the collection have this smooth sole so that the butler doesn't make any noise. And Butler is allowed, because of his silent service, allowed access to the house owner's most personal areas. Yeah. And so they are both prized for their ability to serve silently and stealthily. But when a crime occurs, did the butler do it?
Yeah.
And so this brings up issues of class. It brings up issues of assumptions about crime. The owner of the house might be the person who's a robber baron from, you know, doing huge cultural crimes and is not considered a criminal. So the exhibition, as all our exhibitions do, tries to complicate these concepts.
The museum is just one more way to experience Toronto's vastness.
I mean, Toronto itself is so diverse, and there's so many. If we think of diversity as the opportunity to consider things from many different viewpoints, the fact that we have a collection that allows us to do that, I think, dovetails nicely with what Toronto does and is famous for.
The Bada Shoe Museum is one of more than 50 museums in the city. But there are hundreds of smaller galleries as well, places like Band.
My name is Karen Carter. I'm a co-founder and ED for an arts organization called Black Artist Networks in Dialogue. Band is an art service organization that runs an art gallery.
Karen and I are sitting at a table outside of the organization's temporary space in the 401 Richmond building. 401 Richmond is a restored industrial building that has been turned into an arts and culture hub. It also has these wonderfully creaky wood floors, and as we chat, I can hear footsteps of visitors above us. Karen says that she founded Band in 2010 because she saw that there wasn't a pathway for emerging Black and other racialized artists.
When you looked at the cultural landscape, it felt like dance had something going on, theater had something going on, music. And so the gap was really the visual arts. And that was one of the reasons for wanting to start the organization and have space, knowing that our interest was helping emerging artists because we wanted to help folks develop their career.
Band's business model is different from other organizations because it's not a commercial gallery that splits consignment fees with the artist, and it's not an artist-run gallery. One of the coolest parts about Band is that they will go and see any artist's work.
As long as you came by and asked, we would go see the work. And then if the work was saying something and had clear, obviously, skill, which again, I hate the word skill and talent because I feel like art is so subjective. And a lot of that, again, as subjective as it is about, is there a large enough body of work that's saying something that you should present in the gallery?
And once an artist is selected, Band pays them nearly three times what the average emerging visual artist will make for their work, which hasn't always gone over well.
I remember some artists criticizing us, saying we were giving artists an unrealistic sense of the sector because of giving too much. But for me, that wasn't a reason to not do what we were doing. We were doing what we're doing, and frankly, we were getting corporate support to do what we're doing because it helped the artists.
As we talk, I discover that Karen has had a sizable impact on Toronto's art scene. She helped build Museum, now called the Museum of Toronto, and the idea was that the museum would tell the city's story. Karen is very interested in community cultural practice, she says, and Toronto is a city of very diverse neighborhoods.
That neighborhood diversity is reflected by cultural diversity. So a lot of the neighborhoods, like the Danforth was Greektown, St. Clair was Little Italy, Little Jamaica is Eglinton West. So often there were culturally specific communities that kind of cleaved together in their migration to the city and found and made place together.
Karen says that as the city grows, people move in and out. And so these neighborhoods' characters are shifting.
So Museum was built thinking about the fact that there's a diverse cultural community association for almost every racialized or cultural group in this city. And so the ethos was that you connected with those community groups who are really the keepers of their own stories. They're holding their artifacts and records, usually in cultural associations. And that since the city hadn't been accessioning and deaccessioning and collecting all of that, like traditional museums would, that you had to partner with them in order to have a museum for the city that was representative of the city's diversity.
She's also the founder and creative director of Sea Art, a Caribbean art fair. But a lot of her current focus is on Band, which is in the middle of a remodel of what will be its permanent space. It's an old Victorian house in Parkdale, and the renovation should be complete by the end of 2024.
As they get closer to opening, Karen wants to make sure that people know that Band is about more than just an art gallery, and she wants to broaden the kind of work that they show.
Even do things that are more about the African-Canadian history and culture, which helps with that broader understanding about the presence of Blacks in this country.
She wants Band to be a space for everyone.
So you never want things to feel like, oh, that's a Black cultural space only for Black people. You want it to be actually, the reason this space is here is to make sure, frankly, sometimes more than us, that everybody else knows about us. It's how you can use culture, frankly, as a way to create safe spaces for difficult conversations. It's about that you might see something that leads to a discussion with someone else or may lead literally to a conversation with yourself in your head about something that you probably wouldn't speak because of a particular cultural bias position that you may hold.
Karen still has high ideals about the role of art in society.
I work in the sector I work because I still believe that art and culture is the way to help to find the best of us as human beings.
On my way out, I stop at Band Offsite, their pop-up gallery, to see the current Afrophilia Beloved exhibition. The artist is France Brent Harris, a Jamaican sculptor who now lives in Toronto. In his mission statement, France says that the exhibit is a love letter to Black people and Black ancestors. And there's a wall emblazoned with red and gold illustrations of masked faces, and in front of that are several red busts surrounding a central figure draped in strips of bright fabrics. It's beautiful and arresting, and I stand for several minutes taking it all in. We're going to end this episode with more talk about food because one of the best possible things to do in the city is eat. There's Afghan food, Tibetan food, Russian food. Any culinary dream you have can come true here. And when it comes to Thai food, there is one person who has had an outsized impact.
Sawadee ka. Hello, my name is Chef Nui Rekila. I'm executive chef and co-owner of Pai Restaurants, Kin Restaurants, Chayo by Pai, Sukhothai Restaurants, and Event and Catering by Chef Nui in Toronto, Canada.
She now has 12 restaurants in Toronto, including Kin, where I have a phenomenal 12-course Royal Thai dinner.
Royal Thai cuisine is a cuisine that once cooked and served in the Royal Thai family. So one of the dishes that I cooked, it's, for example, like Khnom Chip Nok or bird-like dumping that created in 220 years ago by the sister of King Rama II.
We start with what I thought was a sculptural wood centerpiece. It looks almost like a tree that's covered in delicate flowers. But I discovered that those flowers are edible.
You have taro chips, tom yum paste right in the middle, homemade, topped with a red pepper. And then the purple leaves are purple yams dusted with tom yum powder. Those are edible. Avoid the tree.
We're tasting Chef Nui's spring menu, and each course is like a little work of art. There are tom yum oysters and a salad that the chef zests with a special kind of citrus at the table.
We like to use the zest and the juice for this dish called yummy guava or crispy vermicelli rice noodles.
We end with several dishes to share, including crab fried rice, a to-die-for piece of wagyu steak, and a banana leaf wrapped dish that the chef's mom once made. The flavors are somewhat familiar, but completely unlike any Thai food I've had before.
The difference between the Royal Thai cuisine and Thai cuisine is, to me, it's very much the same thing, just some more refined, some more of the presentations and high level of the skill, and also with the balance of the flavors that's very different from regular day that we're eating at home. For example, from northern region where I came from, so our food doesn't add a lot of sugar. So we pretty much have the flavor of a little bit salty and sourness and a little bit of the bitterness. So the sweet component in the food, very much that we don't even add sugar at all. But for Royal Thai cuisine, there will be the balance of sweet, sour, salty, and spicy.
This is all part of Chef Nui's mission to change the way people see Thai food. She was born in Thailand, where she worked as a nurse for many years. Her husband Jeff is from Toronto and was backpacking in Thailand when they met. They opened a simple restaurant there, but eventually moved to Toronto. And uninspired by the Thai food she encountered, she opened her first restaurant, Sukha Thai. But it did not go very well at first.
I remember that when I got a call from one of the customers, and right off the bat, the customer was like, "You don't know how to cook Pad Thai." And I was like, for a second pause and quite shocked. And I was like, "I know how to cook Pad Thai because I'm from Thailand."
Yep, that's what people told her, a chef from Thailand. And that's because at the time, Toronto Thai food used some, let's say, untraditional ingredients.
When I moved over to Canada, I decided to go out and check on Thai food. And that time was very much different because the food that I tasted, not the same that I had in Thailand or I cooked for myself. Yeah. And yeah. I was surprised. I was like, oh, why is all the food become like this? And even the color, the flavors, it's slightly like not the same. So by not the same, it's like the Pad Thai that I tried back then was a little bit pinky. It's more not the dark brown or the light brown like we have back home. And then Jeff was like, they put ketchup in Pad Thai. So that's why I was like, okay, I understand. I can see that very much the Thai food scene back then, it's they use whatever local have.
But Chef Nui persevered. She imported Thai ingredients like tamarind paste, and she slowly began to change hearts, minds, and palates. She also added restaurants such as Pai and Selva, and in 2017, she opened Kin, a radical departure for her. She is now celebrated as the person who changed Thai food culture in the city, and people flock to her restaurants in droves, eager for some of her iconic dishes.
I would say Chef Nui Pad Thai. Yeah. No ketchup, guarantee. That's one Pad Thai that used the tamarind paste. And the next one will be Pad Kra Pao or Holy Basil Stir Fry. And the other one I would say Khao Soi, which I think one of the dish that I, from Northern Thai, very proud to be able to bring to Canada, and now one of the favorite dish for most people.
Now she finds that the city's diners are much more open-minded and curious. They want her to take them on a journey.
Very much, I think, Torontonian is very open-minded. And that's one great thing about our city, is like because the diversity of the culture, you know, it's already have like a prep the Torontonian to be more open to different type of cuisine.
The following day, I make my way to one of the city's most fascinating food spots, Kensington Market. It's not an actual market like St. Lawrence, but a colorful, bustling neighborhood with incredible food. And lucky for me, I have a guide.
Okay. So my name is Giuseppe Sim, and I am the founder and the chief epicurean officer of Chopsticks and Forks, a Toronto walking food tour company. And we are currently at New Bugle, which is a first stop of our international food tour and kind of a staple bagel shop here in Kensington Market.
The neighborhood has been here for hundreds of years.
So it got established technically in 1815 when it was actually owned by one family. And then from there, it grew from that humble beginnings over the last 200 plus years.
And it's evolved over the decades.
This neighborhood was called the Jewish Market. If you walked up and down the street in the 60s, you would see live chickens in cages in front of the kosher butcher.
Giuseppe tells me that in the 1970s, American hippies escaping the draft and Jamaican Rastafarians began to settle here.
So you got these two groups that really helped shape the neighborhood and influence their love of art, music, and infiltrated the neighborhood and preserved it. See, on my tour, I explain how the Rastafarians and the hippies from America really kind of helped build the foundation of the culture that we enjoy today.
Giuseppe and I sit down at a table near a fridge filled with beverages. It's actually that thing making the loud buzzing you're hearing when he's talking. And he orders me his favorite bagels. The first is a smoked trout sandwich on a sesame bagel. And the second is almost like dessert, a toasted coconut bagel filled with melty Nutella.
So there are many, many flavors that are inside of this. So chew slowly and the different flavor will hit your tongue at different times. There's arugula, a gourmet horseradish jam, and seeded mustard. See? And you get the textures of the bagel. The arugula kind of mellows a little bit down. Then you get the sharp sweet from the horseradish jam, the earthiness of the mustard.
I am now obsessed with the smoked trout sandwich. Even now, as I record this, I remember that spicy, sweet jam and the perfectly chewy bagel. Giuseppe says he feels the same way.
So when I tried it, I'm like, where's this been all my lives?
As I eat, Giuseppe tells me that Kensington Market is the only ungentrified neighborhood left in the downtown Toronto area. And a lot of that credit is due to a TV show, of all things.
Back in the late 70s and 80s, there was a very popular sitcom called The King of Kensington. And back then, if you had a television, you only had five channels. And so when the show was on, the whole country was watching it and got to learn about this neighborhood. And so when the mass gentrification started to happen in the 80s and 90s all over North America, this neighborhood got spared because it became part of the Canadian culture. And for them to say, announce that they're going to tear this place down for shopping malls and condos, Canadians would have lost their minds.
Now the neighborhood is protected by a trust. And one of the things that Giuseppe loves most about the market is that all of the shops here are family-owned and many have been for generations.
So one of the attributes I note that is very distinct about this particular neighborhood and why I'm quite fond of it is that 99% of all the shops here are family-owned businesses. And the food that is tasted on my food tour, the vast majority is made by people from that country. So the Chilean tasting is made by a Chilean grandma. The Tibetan momos and butter tea are made by a Tibetan mom. And so that is an attribute of our city that I really love showcasing.
New Bugle is one of six stops on Giuseppe's signature international food tour focused on the Kensington Market. His goal is to push people outside of their culinary comfort zones.
And so my menu is designed that people get to tastings of foods that maybe would not be in their radar. And I purposely pick places that would be kind of uncommon. I take people to a Chilean restaurant. And for most people, they don't even know what Chileans eat. Never mind what kind of food might be across their path. And so that's my Latin American stop. My Asia stop is unique in that it's easy to go Korean, Chinese, Japanese. But how many people know where Tibet is? Never mind food from that region. And my European tasting is Swedish. And of course, most people aren't aware that bagels were invented in Poland. And food history, when you start digging into it, can actually be quite entertaining at how certain dishes came about.
Tours are about 2.5 hours long, and he also offers a second tour with a slightly different spin.
It's a 100% fusion food tour. So one of the tastings we start with is a Japanese coconut curry poutine. Cheese curds, bacon bits, sriracha mayo, scallions. Oh, yeah, that's the first tasting on that tour. Complimented with butter coffee. Yeah, but we, again, tell the story of the cultures, then how they merged, and why maybe sometimes the flavors kind of complement each other.
Giuseppe says the food scene continues to evolve as new groups immigrate to the city.
The evolution really is dictated by the number of immigrants from one region, and that usually gets a little bit of an uptick in the food scene. So during the Afghan War, we had a huge influx of Afghan refugees. And now the Afghan food scene is off the hook. After 9/11, we didn't have a lot of Muslims in Toronto. But after 9/11, we saw a massive influx of Muslim immigrants, then completely changed the food scene. So now halal meat is everywhere. And Popeyes was the first chain to adopt halal meat.
Giuseppe says that right now they're seeing an influx of people from Mexico, and that has elevated the city's taco game. These constant changes mean that his job is always changing too, as he keeps up with Toronto's ever-growing diversity, and he loves that about the city.
Every wave brings their own texture. We're a multi-layered cake, but it's got more ingredients and nuances than most cities to ever exist in.
We're heading into the summer season, and everyone I talked to said that this is the time to visit. The sun is shining, the islands are gleaming, and the food, well, it's just waiting for you to dive in. So I'll include links in the show notes to everything we talked about today, as well as a link to Afar's Toronto Travel Guide. It's a great resource. Happy travels! Ready for more unpacking? Visit afar.com and be sure to follow us on Instagram and X. We are at Afar Media.
If you enjoyed today's exploration, I hope you'll come back for more great stories. Subscribing always makes that easy. And be sure to rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platforms. It helps other travelers find it. And if you ever want to ask a question or suggest a topic for coverage, you can reach out to us at afar.com/feedback or email us at unpacked@afar.com. This has been Unpacked, a production of Afar Media. The podcast is produced by Aislinn Green and Nikki Galteland. Music composition by Chris Collin. And remember, the world is complicated. We're here to help you unpack it.